Call your next witness, please.
Brian Brinig.
Brian Brinig, called as a witness by the plaintiff, having been first duly sworn, was examined and testified as follows.
Would you please state your full name and spell your last name for the record?
Brian P. Brinig, B-R-I-N-I-G.
Thank you.
Your Honor, do you have the binder with Exhibit 380?
380? Yes, except I don't know that 380 is in this binder. I was just handed a copy of 380 itself.
Good morning, Mr. Brinig.
Good morning.
Mr. Brinig, what is the general area that you are going to be testifying about today?
I'm going to testify about the value of the stock that was lost by Dr. Zarnik as a result of his termination from Illumina.
And what is your business or occupation, sir?
I'm a certified public accountant, and I specialize in business valuation and economic damages analysis.
Do you have any credentials that qualify you to testify on the subject of economic damages?
Yes, as I mentioned, I'm a certified public accountant. I was licensed in California in 1977. I'm a senior member of the American Society of Appraisers with a designation as Business Enterprise Valuation Specialist. I'm the past president of the Financial Analyst Society of San Diego, and within my professional area, I'm a member of the American Institute of CPAs, the California Society of CPAs, and I should probably say I'm within the California Society of CPAs. I'm the past state chairman of the Business Valuation Committee, and I'm the past San Diego chairman of the CPAs Litigation Services Committee. Litigation services is what CPAs call the kind of work I do. I suppose, in summary, Mr. Pantone, those are my, I guess, credentials, if you will, to testify about economic damages.
Could you give us a brief summary of your educational background?
Sure, very briefly. After college, I was employed by Price Waterhouse in Atlanta, Georgia. Then I was employed by Arthur Young & Company. Those are both international CPA firms. I guess until a couple of months ago, that was sort of a badge, a feather in my cap. But the last couple of months, I was employed by the national CPA firms. Then I went to graduate school at University of San Diego. After that, I had two different jobs in business appraisal. And in 1983, I formed my present firm, Brinig & Company, Incorporated. And for the last 19 years, I've done this kind of work, which is business valuation and economic damages. And I should also mention, I'm also an adjunct professor of finance and accounting at the University of San Diego School of Law, and I've been teaching there for about 5 or 6 years now. So that's my employment summary in a nutshell.
Okay. Your Honor, I would move to qualify Mr. Brinig as an expert to testify regarding economic damage in this case.
Any objection?
No objection. In fact, I thought we stipulated beforehand that both economics experts are experts in the field.
Okay. Mr. Brinig, who retained you in this matter?
I was retained by your offices to do the economic analysis.
And what was your specific assignment in this case?
I was asked to look at the stock, that is, I'm sure you've all been hearing about. I was asked to look at the stock that Dr. Zarnik owned at the time of his termination, and to determine its value for purposes of this matter.
And can you tell us how you are being paid for this engagement?
I bill my time hourly. Like in this and every other engagement, I bill my time at $2.75 an hour and bill associates' time in my office at lesser rates. If gross revenue equaled net revenue, I would be better off, but there are some expenses attached to that.
Can you describe for us, generally speaking, what you did in order to accomplish your assignment?
I asked for and received documents. For instance, I got the stock purchase agreement relating to what I'll call the co-founder shares, the block of 400,000 shares. I got the stock purchase agreement relating to the block of 25,000 shares. I received and read the lockup agreement, the insider trading compliance agreement, which is an agreement at Illumina. I got the report of Dr. Ward, who I understand is the defendant's expert on this subject, the prospectus for Illumina. And I guess those are the outside documents that I got. And then I also did research on the stock prices of Illumina since the time of Dr. Zarnik's termination up to the present time. So those are the documents I got and the outside research that I did in my analysis.
Mr. Brinig, have you prepared a summary of your opinions and conclusions in this case?
Yes, I have. I think it's an 8-page packet of schedules that I prepared in this matter. And then the summary page I've had blown up on a chart.
Is that what we have marked as Exhibit 380?
Yes, it is.
I'll set it on the Elmo.
That's my summary chart, yes.
Actually, I have a blow-up here. You'll use this as well. Get it in front of the jury. So this first page of Exhibit 380 is your conclusion page?
Yes, economic loss conclusions under two scenarios.
Could you describe for us generally what Scenario 1 is?
Yes, I've made these calculations in two different scenarios. And Scenario 1, what I've done is calculated the loss on an ongoing basis based on the trading prices of the stock since the date of termination. So Scenario 1 is what I would call an ongoing basis.
And briefly, what is Scenario 2?
In Scenario 2, what I've done is put, I'm standing at a point in time in Scenario 2, and in Scenario 2, I'm standing on the day of termination, which is September 5, 2000, and I'm standing at that point in time without knowing anything in the future, and I'm valuing the stock based on its trading prices at that point in time without moving forward in time and being able to look back. I'm standing on that day. So what's standing at a point in time is Scenario 2, and Scenario 1 is more an ongoing basis.
Okay. We can see that for each scenario, you treat three different shares.
Blocks.
Blocks of shares. You described for us generally what the three different blocks of shares are that you analyzed.
Sure. There are three different blocks of stock that are in question in this matter. The first block is what I'll call the co-founder stock, and you can see on the chart it's 226,000 shares. I'll just quickly tell you, originally there were 400,000 shares in this block, which was the co-founder stock that Dr. Zarnik got at the beginning. And at the time of termination, he completely owned 173,000 of those shares. And by completely owned, I mean the repurchase right had lapsed on 173,000 of them. So as you see on my chart, we're only talking about the 226,000 in that block that the repurchase right hadn't lapsed on. That's the 226,000 block, which is part of the 400,000 co-founder shares. The second block is a 25,000 share block, which relates to a grant that had to do with what I'm calling a milestone for some kind of genotyping, some scientific stuff that these smart people understand. I don't. I just know it's a milestone that the company achieved at a particular point in time. That's the 25,000. And then the third block, the 100,000 shares, relates to, it's a block that I'm calling, it relates to this ABI company collaboration agreement that occurred at a particular point in time. So that's the third block of stock. In total, I'm dealing with three blocks of stock in both scenarios.
Okay, I'm going to move this up here, get it out of our way for the time being. If we could take a look at your Schedule 1.2A.
That's the second page of my little package. That is Exhibit 380.
Sorry for the dizziness here. Can you tell us generally what you have done on this particular schedule? What does this schedule reflect?
Sure, and I promise, Mr. Pantone, this is the only one I'll go through in elaborate detail, and the elaborate detail won't even be that much. What I'll fast forward and tell you is I basically have done the same analysis for each of the three blocks. I suppose it would be helpful if I briefly explained one of the analyses to you in summary detail, and then I'm going to be able to tell you the second block and the third block I did the same way.
Which block does this relate to?
This relates to the first block, the 226,000 remaining. We can call it the original co-founder stock, which was originally 400,000, and there were 226,000 of it left on the date of termination. What you have in the chart in front of you is the scenario, one analysis, which you can see written at the top of the chart, and you didn't point out when we looked at the conclusions. But in each case, I'm dealing with the past loss and the future loss. The past loss being the stock that was lost from now back to the time of termination in the past. And the future loss, which we're not talking about yet, is where we sit today, the stock that would be yet to be released. So as I sit today, we've got past loss and future loss. This is the analysis of the past loss on the 226,000 shares.
What was the date you did this evaluation to distinguish between the past and the future?
It's as of last Friday, June 28th.
And you say this schedule, Schedule D1.2A, deals with past loss of the 226,000 share block.
Correct. I approached it this way. In my scenario one, where I told you this was evaluating the stock on an ongoing basis, here's the concept. The concept is that the date of termination back here, we're here today, at the date of termination, Dr. Zarnik had 226,000 shares for which the right to repurchase was not yet released. Number one. Number two, we know by looking, or I know by looking at the stock agreement, that every month 6,666 shares were released from the right to repurchase. So in concept, if there were no other factors, and there are two, which I'll tell you about in a minute, if there were no other factors, what I'm doing in this analysis is simply taking the price of the stock at every month on the 15th of the month when 6,666 shares are released, and again, subject to a qualification that I'll deal with in a minute, on this ongoing basis, what I would simply do is every month on the 15th of the month, I would look at the stock price in the newspaper or on the internet, and I would value the stock at that price. And I would say there are 666,000 shares that just became freely tradable at, let's just say, $10 a share. So that would be 66,666 at that point in time. In the simplest world on scenario one, in an ongoing basis, that's what I would do.
When you say every month 6,666 shares were released, that's what's reflected in this column of your summary?
Correct. That's the release from the repurchase right, or the time at which that number of shares had no restriction on them whatsoever on this point. It had no restriction as far as the company's right to repurchase them.
Why is there no market price listed for the first few share blocks of 6,666?
Well, I mentioned nothing is perfectly simple. In a perfect world, I would just take the stock price on the 15th of each month. There are two things in this situation that affect my ability to just take the stock price every month and why I didn't. The first thing that affects his ability to sell the stock is what's called a lockup restriction. A lockup restriction is the following thing. It is a requirement that prohibits the owners, the inside owners of this stock, from selling it for 6 months from the date of the initial public offering. So there was a lockup restriction on this stock that prohibited the sale of the stock until about January 22nd or 23rd of year 2001.
You're talking about 6 months after the IPO.
That's correct.
Did you consider the effect of the lockup, the six-month lockup, in scenario one?
Yes, and you'll see, for instance, I'm going to put little... The answer is yes. You'll see there's no market price in any of those dates before January of 01, or even February of 01. So I did consider the lockup restriction, and I allowed no selling or no market price to exist because he couldn't have sold the stock during the lockup period.
When did you assume, if you did, that Dr. Zarnik could sell stock?
The second little hiccup, Mr. Pantone, is what's called the trading window. This is the last stick-up. The trading window is a hiccup. That is a time period where certain employees who are considered to be insiders, certain employees are allowed to sell their stock in particular trading windows. They're not allowed to sell their stock outside the trading window. The reason this exists is to make sure that there isn't any accusation of insider trading in a company like this where theoretically somebody could know something and they could call their broker and sell some stock. So the company has an agreement with its employees that says you will only sell stock during a trading window. So that's the only time that Dr. Zarnik could sell the stock. So that's the second sort of qualification that keeps me from just taking the stock price every month when the shares were released. I could only sell them during the trading window. It just happens, Mr. Pantone, if you will, with your little laser thing, mark the lockup period, which ends in late January of 01. So I have nothing before the lockup period in terms of a market price. But I'll tell you, even if the lockup period didn't apply, the trading window still applied. So we go all the way down to the first line where I show the average price from April 30 to 5/31. That's the first trading window. That's the first time that he could have sold any of the stock that would have been released prior to it. So what you see on my schedule is I summarize or add up all the prior releases into the trading window period, and there's 53,333 shares. Then moving to the right, what I do now, we're in a trading window, I take the average price during the 30-day trading window, which was $9.63, and I value all the stock that's been released prior to that point, this time at $513,000. So, to quickly summarize, I'd like to do it every month. In other words, he gets the stock, he could theoretically call his broker, but he can't because the trading window isn't there. So I add up all the past stock, value it at the average trading window price, and that becomes the value of the stock received up to that trading window.
Real quickly then, what's this little single block of 6,666 shares that you referenced there?
There's always another little complication. He gets stock on the 15th of every month. The first trading window is April 30th to May 31st. So come May 15th, he gets released another 6,600 shares. It's in the middle of the trading window. What I do with that little odd lot is I value that at the average price for the last half of the trading window because that stock happened in the middle of the trading window. Then I move down and continue this same process because there are three trading windows that have happened in the past that I'm aware of. And every time, moving down the chart, I take the stock that's been released from the last trading window to now, and you can see June 15th and July 15th because the next trading window is in the August 10 to August 31 period. And then without being too repetitive, I simply repeat the process. I take the 13,000 shares that have been released since the last time at the average price during the trading window, moving over to the right, and I value it. All the way from the date of termination until now, moving down to the very bottom of the chart, Mr. Pantone, with all of that, the stock, all of the stock from the 226,000 block that has been released in the past, valued during the trading windows, is at $1,112,000 at the average market price during the trading window. And that becomes my past loss, which is on the first sheet, for the 226,000 share block past $1,102,188. And that's the simple analysis on the past loss in scenario one, which I call the ongoing basis, where I can keep changing the stock price because I use this ongoing benefit of hindsight to know what the stock price changed to.
All right. Let's take a quick look at one of your analyses for the future. You describe you also did an analysis for future losses.
Yes.
This is schedule D1.4, correct?
Correct.
Can you tell us, essentially walk us through your analysis of the future loss for the 226,000 share block?
Okay, let me just orient you, if I may, for 1 second. Remember on this block, which we're calling the 226,000 block, at the rate of termination there were, going back in time, there were 226,000 shares that hadn't been released. In the past, from now back to the date of termination, of those shares, 146,000 of them have been released in the past. As we sit today, if you were sitting today in the employment, there would still be 80,000 shares that exist today for which the restriction has not been removed. So that's the context in which we come to the future analysis. So we have a person who is sitting today with 80,000 shares of stock. He has complete ownership in the shares in terms of their voting rights, their ability to receive dividends that are paid. They happen not to have been paid in this company, but he completely owns the stock except for one thing. He is prohibited from selling the stock until somebody else's right to repurchase it is removed. We also know the right to repurchase removed 6,000 shares per month. So, put yourself in that setting in order to understand how I've done the future analysis. You own the stock, you completely own it today. We know what the price today is in the free market, but you can't sell it yet.
Now, I noticed that in this future loss analysis, you priced all of the shares at $6.72 per share.
Well, for starters, yes.
Why did you start with that price?
That's today's fair market value of the stock, or Friday's. If you could call your broker and say, I want to sell 80,000 shares of stock. So, you're sitting, you own the stock completely, but there's one restriction. You cannot sell it. And in finance and in valuation, when you have the restriction that you can't sell it, it's called a lack of marketability discount. You completely own it except for one thing. You cannot sell it until some period of time lapses, and that is a lack of marketability discount.
Tell us how you considered the lack of marketability, the fact he couldn't sell these shares until they were released from the repurchase restriction. How did you consider that in making your assessment of what those shares are worth?
In finance and valuation and stock valuation, there's the concept of lack of marketability discount. There are a number of studies that indicate what kinds of discounts the market places on a lack of marketability restriction or a marketability restriction, and the studies follow two tracks. One is valuing what is called restricted stock or letter stock, meaning in many publicly traded companies there will be freely traded stock that you can open the newspaper and see what the true fair market value per share is, which for Illumina is $6.72, and then at the same time there are certain shareholders who own restricted stock who may do private transactions that are reported in the restricted stock. There are studies of the discount differential between the freely traded and the restricted stock, and that's one series of studies that exist. I must tell you, the studies aren't perfect. They expend a large period of time. There are a lot of them. But when you look at the studies in total, the midpoint of the discounts of lack of marketability for these kinds of stock is about, I think it's 32.8% or right around 33%. The other type of study, by the way, is a study of the companies that go public and an analysis of their stock before they go public and after in close proximity so you can see the variation. Those studies exist. I've looked at them. Looking at the totality, the studies, keeping in mind they're not precise, they're thought perfectly comparable, I looked at the fact that these shares are restricted from being sold, not in total, for in total June of 2003, but on a decreasing basis until June of 2003. Looking at that, I used approximately the midpoint of the average of the marketability studies of 33%, and I concluded that looking at the stock that he holds today, we know the value of it. We don't know if it's going to go up or down in the future. The best estimate of value today is to look at the fair market value minus a discount for lack of marketability, which I used 33% discount, and therefore valued the shares.
Again, how did you come up with that 33% as the discount rate to apply?
Looking at all the studies of the marketability discounts that exist, and there are 10 or 12 of them, Mr. Pantone, and considering that the length of time for this restriction is about a year and 3 months on a decreasing basis, and it's a little different in the other two blocks, but it's not an extremely long time, I use the midpoint of the various studies, which is about 33%, and that's what I use for my lack of marketability. Basically, I took the shares he holds today, the current fair market value, reduced it by 33%, and used that as the best estimate of value for the stock that he would have owned today that have yet been subject to the marketability or the repurchase restriction. And that amount for the block of the 226,000 shares is $480,256.
Is that number your opinion as to the total future loss for this block of shares? Is that depicted on your summary?
It's the present value of the loss of shares that have yet to be released, and I have it under the category of future value, 480,000. So, with respect to the 226,000 block, in the past 1,000,001, and in the future, 480,000.
All right. Now, Mr. Brinig, I take it from your prior testimony you conducted similar analyses for the other two blocks of stock in this case.
Exactly the same analysis. Past and future, limited to the trading windows, valuing the stock during the trading windows in the past, and in the future, looking at the remaining stock that would exist today and using the same marketability discount analysis for both the 25,000 share block and the 100,000 share block, and that's all summarized on my chart and the schedules I have in the packet.
Keep them in the packet for this point.
Sounds great to me.
Let's shift over to scenario two.
Just to guide you, Mr. Pantone, your direct time is exhausted, I think.
45 minutes?
Half hour?
We estimated 45 minutes, Judge.
You did? You're right. The hour was not evenly divided.
If you could remind us again what you were looking at in your scenario two.
In scenario two, we're standing at a point in time. Scenario one was looking at things in an ongoing basis. Scenario two is standing at a point in time, and the point in time that we're standing in, scenario two, is not today. It is the date of termination of Dr. Zarnik from Illumina on September 5th, 2000. We're standing at that point in time, and we don't know anything else, Mr. Pantone.
Why do you think it's appropriate to value the shares standing in the point of time of the date of termination? Why do you think that's an appropriate way to measure damages?
A couple of minutes ago, I told you in scenario one, we know about some stuff in the past, but we now sit today. And if Dr. Zarnik were sitting here today, he would still have some number of shares. We know the market price today. We don't know if it's going to go up or down, but we have to value those shares as we sit today. And you switching gears on scenario two, if you go back to the date of termination, and you put yourself on that date, then if you just sit there and say to yourself, I don't know if this stuff is going to go up or it's going to go down, the question is, what is the value of this stuff on this day with everything that we know in time on this day? And in finance and valuation, that is, I'm not saying legally it's the right answer, but that's an accepted way to look at something. We have the value of a building on a given day. 3 weeks later, maybe an earthquake destroys the building. But on a certain day, you can't know the earthquake is going to happen or the value is going to increase 50 times. You can stand on a day and best estimate the value of something, and that's what I'm doing in scenario two.
Can you walk us through how you estimated the value of the lost shares as of the date of termination?
With the background that you now have, it's very simple. At the date of termination on September 5 of 2000, we know the fair market value of the shares is freely traded. It was $45.38 a share.
How do you know that?
That's by simply looking at the high-low stock price on that day, taking the average of it reported, information on the internet, that was the stock price, just like calling your broker. We know that fact. So, put yourself on that day, Mr. Pantone. You own 226,000 shares, 25,000 shares, and 100,000 shares. Today, hypothetically, or on September 5th of 2000. If you could sell that stock, you could call your broker and say, I want to execute a trade at today's market value, and it would happen at $45.38. But you can't do it. There's only one thing keeping you from doing it, a restriction, a contractual provision, or an SEC provision, or a legal provision that keeps you from exercising one incidence of ownership, and that's the ability to sell.
How did you take into account, then, the fact that Dr. Zarnik couldn't sell these shares on the date of termination?
That concept is a marketability discount.
Same thing you talked about before?
Same thing, but at this point in time, I used the high end of the range of marketability discount, 50%. The reason I used that is if you go back to September of 2000, the restriction extends longer into the future than the one I used in the future analysis in scenario one, where I'm sitting here today and I have shorter in the future. So, in September of 2000, the restriction extends for quite a long period of time. Again, it decreases every month, but it still extends for quite a long period of time.
What percentage rate did you apply for the marketability discount in this, scenario two?
50% marketability discount. Again, I'm going to tell you there's no way you can calculate and come up with the number 50%. I look at the studies. 50% is at the high end of the range, not the highest, but the high end of the range of marketability discounts. When I'm doing it back at the time in 2000, I look at a fairly lengthy period for those restrictions to be completely off. I say that's the high end of the range of marketability discounts. I use 50%.
One final question on this scenario, too. Haven't you ignored the fact we know now today the stock is worth significantly less than $45 a share? You know it's roughly trading at $6.72 a share.
Have we ignored it? I would say no. We haven't ignored it in the sense that we looked at the stock on that day and we valued it with the significant discounts in it because you can't sell it. But I guess I would say it this way. If I damage your car, if I steal your car, it's a $10,000 car and I steal it 3 months ago. We don't know if your car... We know the blue book value of your car on that day. We don't know if 2 months after I destroy your car, if 60 Minutes is going to do a study on your kind of car that's going to cause the value to go down, or your car is going to become some priceless relic and everybody wants and cause the price to go up. We're standing on that day, and we value the car on that day. So something, the earthquake could happen that destroys it 2 months later. I don't know that on that day, or something could happen that causes it to go up. I don't know that. All I can do when I stand at a point in time is use everything I know at that moment in time. And one of the things I know in this case is that the stock is restricted from being sold. How can I factor that? I can use a marketability discount to reduce its value significantly from the freely traded value, apply that, that's the value, and that's the value on that day. 2 years later, we might look back and say, gosh, it became worth $50 million. Geez, we were wrong. Or it became worth $1.10. We were wrong. We can only know what we knew on that day, and that's the theory of scenario two.
Looking back again at your conclusion sheet, if you could tell the jury, please, what your opinion is as to total damages, economic damages incurred by Dr. Zarnik under scenario one, and the same question as to scenario two.
When I add up in scenario one, which is the ongoing basis, when I add up the three blocks of stock in the past, make a small subtraction for some purchase price that they've had to pay, but I add up the value of the stock in the past on an ongoing basis and the value that he would own now, the total economic loss under scenario one is $2,423,000. Under scenario two, where I stand in time back to the date of termination when the stock price was $45 a share, the total value of his loss, if valued at that point in time, is $7,965,000. Those are my opinions.
Thank you, sir. Nothing further.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pantone. You are well under your time estimate.
Yes, Your Honor.